Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're going beyond chanting, exploring a lesser-known aspect of Nichiren Buddhism, Kwajikido, or, as it's more commonly known, ritual prayer.
Ah, yes. Fascinating stuff.
It is. It's surprisingly complex. Yeah. It draws on ancient traditions and powerful deities.
It's really a whole nother dimension of practice. We'll unravel how it all fits together.
Exactly. So today we'll trace the roots of Kwajikido.
All right.
We'll uncover the key figures who shaped it.
Okay.
And we'll even see how Nichiren himself integrated it into his teachings.
You know what? It might even surprise some listeners to find that Kwajikido really challenges
it does.
Common assumptions about what prayer even means.
It really does.
Yeah.
So to understand Kwajikido,
yes,
we need to go back to its origins
right.
in esoteric Buddhism, Mikkyo. Yeah. Which originated in India.
Right. We need to go way back before Japan.
Yeah.
Before Nichiren. Back to ancient India, really. This is where esoteric Buddhism emerged with a focus on experiencing a deep, like...
A deep,
almost mystical connection with the universe and with the Buddha. And they used, you know...
They used what?
Rituals, symbols, and mantras.
Okay.
As tools for accessing a deeper reality.
So they were kind of using a secret language.
Oh, right? Yeah. That's a great way to put it. It wasn't just about intellectual understanding, you know?
Right.
It was about directly experiencing... Directly experiencing wisdom and power.
Wow. Okay, so we have these fascinating practices developing in India. So how did they make their way over to Japan?
Well, Mikkyo spread really gradually, reached Tibet, China, and then finally Japan.
Okay.
And that's where things get really interesting.
Yeah, I bet. Japan has such a rich spiritual history, so
exactly.
Who are the key figures that brought Mikkyo to Japan?
Well, two major figures, really, Kukai, the founder of Shingon Buddhism, and Saicho, who founded Tendai Buddhism.
Okay.
Each of them had their own distinct interpretation of Mikkyo.
So we had these two powerful personalities, each leaving their mark on Japanese Buddhism. Let's start with Kukai and Shingon Buddhism.
Okay.
What were some of their core beliefs?
Well, central to Shingon is this concept of the three mysteries.
The three mysteries.
The three mysteries. Body, mouth, and spirit.
Okay.
Representing...
The
interconnectedness of all things and the potential for enlightenment, you know, within us.
So it's not just about the mind.
No.
It's about the whole being.
Absolutely. The body is a vehicle for enlightenment, really.
Mm.
Another key element is the use of mandalas.
Mandalas.
Yeah, particularly the womb and diamond realm mandalas.
Okay, and what role do they play?
Well, they're visual representations of the cosmos and the enlightened state.
Okay.
The womb realm symbolizes compassion and wisdom, you know,
manifesting
in the world. And the diamond realm represents this.
This is what, Claude?
Unchanging nature of reality.
So they're using these, like, intricate visuals to contemplate these profound concepts.
They are.
Okay.
Did Shingon emphasize enlightenment in this lifetime?
Yeah,
it did. And that resonated deeply with people at the time.
Mm, okay.
Now, Saicho and Tendai Buddhism offered a slightly different approach.
How so? How did Saicho's vision differ from Kukai's?
Well, Saicho wanted to harmonize esoteric Buddhism with other Buddhist teachings.
So not an either, but a bohand.
Exactly. And Saicho also introduced the Lotus Sutra to Japan, which, of course, became the central text for Nichiren Buddhism later on.
Right.
And he also championed this idea of Ichinen Sansen.
Ichinen Sansen. What's that?
3,000 worlds in a single moment of consciousness.
Whoa. So every single moment contains, like, infinite potential.
It does. It suggests that every thought, every action, you know, ripples throughout the cosmos.
That's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, it is. And it would become key
to
Nichiren Buddhism.
Okay. But going back to Saicho and Kukai, you know, given that they both had such strong personalities, I imagine their relationship was bound to get a little complicated.
Yeah. Well, initially, you know, they collaborated. Saicho even received teachings from Kukai. But, you know, over time, their interpretations of esoteric Buddhism diverged, right?
Yeah.
Which led to a lot of tension and ultimately
falling out.
So Mikkyo in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
Had its share of drama right from the start.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So this kind of sets the stage for, you know, a truly fascinating figure.
It does.
Nichiren.
Yes.
But before we jump into his story.
Right. We have to.
We have to wait.
We need to understand the context.
Okay.
Nichiren lived in 13th century Japan, which was a time of immense upheaval.
So paint the picture for us. Like, what was going on that made this period so turbulent?
Okay, well, imagine Japan in a state of crisis. Political turmoil, natural disasters, famine, disease.
People were really struggling, and there was this growing sense
of what?
That they were living in Mapo.
Mapo. And what does that mean exactly?
Well, it literally means the latter day of the Dharma.
Okay.
Which is a time when Buddhist teachings are said to lose their power and the world descends into chaos.
So it's like a feeling of end times.
Exactly.
According to Buddhist belief.
Right.
And so in this scene walks Nichiren, ready to shake things up.
He was, Nichiren was this fiery, determined monk who offered a radical solution. He believed the only path to salvation for both individuals and Japan itself was through the Lotus Sutra.
Wow. He sounds like a revolutionary figure.
Yeah, he was. He was known for his confrontational style and for his bold prophecies. I mean, he even predicted a foreign invasion.
Wow.
And for his just unwavering belief in his mission, he was exiled twice, you know.
Exiled.
Yeah, twice for his critiques of other Buddhist schools and even the government.
Wow. Talk about standing up for your convictions.
He was truly dedicated. A true believer in the power of the Lotus Sutra to transform lives and even society.
Yeah. And given his focus on the Lotus Sutra, how do you think he felt about, you know, Nikkyo? You think he was a fan?
My guess is he wasn't Lotus Sutra or bus, right?
Sure, you're on the right track. Nichiren was very critical of esoteric Buddhism, especially Shingon Buddhism.
Okay.
He saw it as a distraction from the pure teachings of the Lotus Sutra.
Yeah.
But here's where it gets interesting. Despite all of his criticisms, he still seems to have integrated certain elements of Mikkyo into his own teachings.
So wait.
Yeah.
He was borrowing from the tradition that he was criticizing?
It appears. Okay. So specifically, he incorporated mandalas.
Okay.
And the concept of Ishinin Sansen into his own version of Buddhism.
Okay, so now that's a twist. Yep. So was he just being pragmatic? Was he just using tools that he thought could help him
get his message across?
Yeah.
Or was there like a deeper connection?
That's the million-dollar question.
It is.
To answer it, we need to dive into the specifics of Kajikido and Nichiren Buddhism.
Okay, so let's unpack Kajikido, Nichiren Buddhism.
Okay.
What are the key elements that we really need to understand?
Well, first we have to differentiate between Kaji and Kido.
Okay.
So think of Kaji as like a kind of spiritual power or blessing that's transmitted through rituals.
Like a force that can, you know, create positive change.
Exactly. And Kido is the act of prayer, often performed by a trained priest to... channel this Kaji towards specific goals.
So the priest kind of acts like a conduit, right?
Yeah.
Connecting that that power to the needs of the world.
That's a great way to think about it. Now, for Nichiren, the most potent form of Kajikido was chanting the Odaimoku.
Okay.
Nam-myoho-renge-kyo. He saw it as a direct link to the infinite wisdom of the Lotus Sutra.
Right.
Right. And you know, Nichiren famously believed that anyone could chant to access this power, not just priests.
Absolutely. That was revolutionary at the time.
Yeah.
Empowering individuals
was
really central to his mission.
Was.
But beyond the Odaimoku, Nichiren also performed specific Kajikido rituals.
Okay, like what?
Like, for example, he prayed for his mother's recovery from illness.
Okay.
He performed a rain prayer during a drought.
Oh, wow.
He even cured a local regent's ailment.
Wow. He was really putting the spiritual power to the test in all sorts of situations.
Yeah. He was fearless in his faith. Now, after Nichiren's death, Kajikido didn't just fade away.
Right.
It evolved. And it kind of split into distinct lineages, each with its own approach.
So different branches of Nichiren Buddhism kind of developed their own interpretation of Kajikido.
Exactly. Two major branches emerged, the Nakayama method and the Mount Minobu method.
You know, were their approaches vastly different?
Well, the Nakayama method emphasizes accessibility.
Okay.
And it focuses on everyday challenges and concerns. It's about helping ordinary people navigate life's difficulties.
Right. And that aligns with, you know, Nichiren's vision of really empowering individuals through chanting.
It does.
What about the Mount Minobu method?
Well, the Mount Minobu method tends to be more traditional,
right,
with a focus on preserving ancient rituals and lineage.
It's a more like esoteric and hierarchical approach.
You could say that, but both lineages share this core belief in the power of Kagetido to transform lives and to make a positive impact.
Yeah. So now let's talk about Argyo.
Okay.
This practice that truly tests one's limits.
Oh, yeah. So imagine chanting for hours every day, strict diets, cold water purification rituals, and complete isolation. It's a grueling test of endurance.
Wow.
It's designed to push practitioners to their physical and mental limits.
So, wow, that sounds intense. What's the purpose of such an extreme
practice? Well, it's about purification, deepening one's connection to the Lotus Sutra, and really cultivating immense spiritual power to perform these powerful Kagetido rituals. You can kind of think of it as refining yourself as a conduit,
right,
for spiritual energy.
So not for the faint of heart. And there are different levels of Argyo.
There are. Each one grants you access to more specialized knowledge.
And to master Nichiren Kagetido, you're expected to complete Argyo, like, five times.
Talk about dedication, right?
Wow.
But no deep dive into Kagetido would be complete without...
Without what?
Exploring the role of deities.
Right.
Okay. Because they're central to these practices.
All right, let's talk deities then. Which ones are particularly important in Nichiren Buddhist Kagetido?
Well, it's a fascinating mix drawn from esoteric Buddhism and Japanese folk beliefs, but three key figures would be Hariti, the Ten Rapsasas, and Mahakala.
Okay, starting with Hariti.
Okay.
Tell us more about her.
So Hariti is the protector of children.
Okay.
But here's the twist. She's often depicted with this fierce, demon-like face.
Oh, wait, a protector who looks like a demon. That's unexpected. What's the story there?
Well, her story is really a tale of transformation.
Okay.
Originally, she was this child-stealing demon, but she converted to Buddhism and then vowed to protect children.
Wow.
It's a powerful reminder that even demons can change, right?
Redemption arcs are always compelling.
They are.
So how is she invoked in Kagetido?
Well, she's called upon for protection, especially for children.
Okay.
And she's also associated with fertility and childbirth.
Okay.
Now on to the Ten Rakshasas.
Ten Rakshasas.
Yes.
So, like, demon bodyguards.
You could say that. They're a force to be reckoned with.
Mm-hmm.
These female demons vow to protect those who uphold the Lotus Sutra.
Yeah.
They're invoked for protection from harm and for overcoming obstacles. It's like having a spiritual army on your side.
Yeah, okay. I'm getting a sense of how these deities kind of lend their power to Kagetido.
They do.
What about Mahakala?
Okay, so Mahakala is a wrathful deity, but his wrath is directed towards negativity and evil.
Okay.
He embodies good fortune and the ability to overcome obstacles.
So he's called upon for, like, strength and success.
Exactly. People invoke him to remove obstacles, grant wishes, and bring prosperity. The belief is that, you know, by invoking these deities, you're tapping into their potent energies.
Right. Okay.
Now, let's shift gears for a second to a unique ritual called Boken Kaji. It involves a wooden sword, a boken, and a rosary.
Okay.
Or yuzu.
A wooden sword and a ritual. Now, that definitely piques my curiosity. What's the symbolism behind Boken Kaji?
Well, the boken symbolizes cutting through.
Cutting through what?
Negativity and illusion.
Okay.
And the juzu represents connection to the Buddha's teachings and accumulating positive karma. It's a powerful combination.
So the boken kind of clears the way.
Yeah.
And then the juzu connects you to a higher purpose.
Beautifully put. The ritual itself involves chanting kuji.
Kuji.
Which are these hand gestures.
Okay.
And this belief in driving away negativity while inviting in positive forces.
So it sounds like a very active form of prayer, right? Engaging both mind and body.
Absolutely. While some might see these rituals as, you know, superstition or whatever, for practitioners, they're a deep and meaningful way to connect with something larger than themselves.
Yeah, it's a reminder that prayer can take many forms.
They can.
And that there are countless paths to meaning and purpose.
There are.
And it's important to approach these practices with respect and an open mind. So as we kind of move toward wrapping up our deep dive into Kaji Kido, I'm curious about the relevance of, you know, Kaji Kido in the modern world.
Mm.
You know, it's easy to see how it resonated in, you know, turbulent 13th century Japan.
Right.
But does it still hold meaning for us? You know?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one that a lot of people grapple with.
Yeah.
You know, we live in such a secular, scientific, technologically driven world, right? It's easy to dismiss these ancient practices as relics of the past, mere superstition.
Yeah.
Especially with all the distractions and instant gratification we're bombarded with today.
Right.
You know, committing to something as demanding as Bargio,
right.
It takes real dedication.
Yeah, it does. But, you know, this human need for meaning
right.
and connection and purpose,
yeah.
that hasn't disappeared, right?
It hasn't.
I mean, people are still seeking ways to cope with suffering.
Yeah.
Find solace, you know?
Right.
And make sense of their lives in a world that can feel, you know, chaotic at times.
Absolutely. I mean, think about it. The anxieties that people faced in, you know, the 13th century Japan.
Yeah.
They're not that different.
They're not.
From the challenges we face today, just maybe on a different scale.
Yeah. No, that's a very insightful
thank you.
Observation.
So for a lot of people, Kaji Kido offers this tangible way to engage with these challenges, to tap into a kind of strength and wisdom that transcends the individual ego, right?
Right.
It's about connecting to something larger than yourself, to a centuries-old lineage of practice.
And, you know, while the rituals and deities might seem, you know, a little foreign to some, I think the underlying principles of compassion, interconnectedness, you know, this transformative power of prayer are really
timeless and universal.
Yeah. It's a reminder that spirituality isn't just about these abstract ideas, but it's about, you know,
putting them into practice.
Putting them into practice, exactly.
Right.
But when we talk about Kaji Kido, with its focus on overcoming obstacles and achieving specific goals, does it, you know, kind of cross the line into like magical manipulation?
Yeah.
Like, chant this mantra and all your problems will vanish.
You know, that's a common misconception.
It is.
The true power of Kaji Kido, you know, lies in its ability to transform the practitioner, to cultivate compassion, gratitude, perseverance.
Right.
It's about aligning oneself with the universe, not, you know, bending it to our will.
So it's about trust in, you know, the wisdom of the practice, you know, this lineage that came before us.
Right.
And recognizing, I think, the interconnectedness of all beings.
That's a big part of it.
Right. And I think Kaji Kido reminds us that our actions have consequences, that our well-being is, you know, intertwined with others.
It is.
And that we have this this responsibility to, you know, to work for the benefit of all. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And maybe this blend of ancient wisdom and pragmatic action has something to offer our increasingly complex world.
I think so. It encourages us to look inward, you know, cultivate this inner strength and then act with compassion and wisdom.
It's a reminder that, you know, even in the darkness, there's hope.
Yeah.
And we each have the power to make a real difference.
Yeah. What a beautiful and inspiring message to end our deep dive into Kaji Kido.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with this thought-provoking question, okay?
Okay.
Could the seeming magic of Kaji Kido be pointing to, you know, a deeper truth about the interconnectedness of all things?
Mm.
A truth that, you know, science is only beginning to grasp.
Right.
You know, something to ponder as you continue your exploration of this fascinating practice.
That's certainly a question to sit with. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
On this deep dive. And until next time, keep learning.
Keep learning.
Keep questioning and keep diving deep.